Hello, everyone. This is Jessica Burbank with the Damage Report. It's day two of my takeover of the Damage Report. And John, if you're out there watching, look at me. I'm the captain now. Rumors are already spreading about there being a peaceful transition of power when John gets back. But we have a really great show for you again today. We're talking about rent inflation. The rent is too damn high. Are we in a recession? And other stories. We've got Anna Kasparian here. I can't imagine someone better to tackle this with us today. How are you doing, Anna?
Hey, I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me. And I don't know, I love the drums. So maybe not a peaceful transition of power. Let's have a little bit of fun. Why not?
Yeah, let's stir the pot. Just let's keep it interesting. Amazing. Are you ready to get into this first story?
For sure. Let's do it.
Let's do it. All right. Everybody is asking it. Are we heading into a recession? Let's start with what the Biden administration is saying about this directly. So in a White House press briefing, they wrote that both official determinations of recessions and economists' assessment of economic activity are based on a holistic look at the data, including the labor market, consumer and business spending, industrial production and incomes. Based on these data, it is unlikely that the decline in GDP in the first quarter of this year, even if followed by another GDP decline in the second quarter, indicates a recession. So there is a rumor that two consecutive quarters of GDP decline is the one thing that means we are in a recession. But as the White House accurately pointed out, recessions are more about how people are doing economically, and you can't really determine this with any one statistic or metric. So they're right about that. But it really sounds like they're downplaying the risk of a recession that we are in right now. So what are they missing? The Democrats tweeted this out from their Twitter account. Reducing the deficit is one of the main ways we can ease inflationary pressures. And Joe Biden is on track for the largest deficit cut in history this year, over $1.7 trillion. But reducing the deficit is not necessarily something to brag about. Janet Yellen said recently in a press conference that we are in a period where there's significant financial drag, very significant financial drag. She said this because a huge factor in economic growth and economic stability is a well-managed money supply, and you need money to get things done. Everybody knows you've got to have money to make money. You need money to put people to work and pay their wages, to purchase land, to purchase machinery and tools, things that are necessary to get things done. You need money to mobilize resources and labor. You've got to put money into the economy to put our productive capacity to use. A rapid reduction in the money supply, it can curb growth and really jeopardize the stability of our economy. Economist Wayne Godley, who became very popular because he was quite effective at predicting recessions, he put it this way. He said there are three main sources for us to increase the money supply. One, the private sector, so think of households and businesses. The other, the US government, the Fed. And the third, the foreign sector. For any sector of our economy to be in surplus, another one has to be in deficit. This often means the federal deficit. And the federal deficit isn't necessarily debt. It's simply a record of all of the dollars put out into the economy that haven't yet been taxed back out. And these dollars are not necessarily backed with bonds. When the federal deficit increases, more dollars are out in the economy. It's simply a record of the dollars that have gone out. They're a surplus for everyone in the private sector. So all of those households and all of those businesses. And as Stephanie Kelton, Bernie's former chief economist, would put it, their red ink that they mark down as deficit is our black ink. That's money circulating in the economy. She would also warn us that constraining the federal deficit too much can plunge the private sector, so households and businesses, into deficit. And for them, that is debt. That is money that they have to pay back to someone else. And that is a condition that has led to recessions in the past. But the Biden administration has boasted a lot about the recovery, that things are looking better. People are spending money on goods and services, flying in planes again, eating out and shopping and spending money. The recovery looks good for the upper class in the United States. Bill McBride at Calculated Risk tweeted this out. He said, we're back, and we see this graph here. Let's leave this up for a second. It seems great. whereas it took 75 months to claw back nearly 9 million jobs that were lost during the Great Recession, see the blue line for 2007. It took just 30 months to add back the 22 million jobs that were lost during the COVID recession, instead of yet another long and painless or long and painful job recovery. Instead, we got a V-shaped job full recovery. So that's the red line there. That's how Stephanie Kelton would put it. And I would point to this V-shaped line and say that this fast recovery was thanks to the spending of the American Rescue Plan. But as the Biden administration said, we can't just look at GDP or jobs and say, look, the economy's back, we've recovered. You really do have to look at all of the data. And what the data shows is pretty concerning. The true story here is that most everyday working people in the United States are cutting back on spending and are working more jobs. A month ago, people were concerned with what Walmart was reporting on. CBS wrote, Walmart reported that high costs for food are squeezing customers' ability to spend on discretionary items like furniture and electronics. So an analysis of consumer spending at Walmart showed everyday people were cutting back a month ago when people were bragging about the recovery. This month, Walmart has seen an uptick in revenue, and people are taking this as a sign that we might not actually be at risk of a recession. But this isn't because people are spending more money at Walmart. It's because people are leaving other more expensive stores, and Walmart's seen an increase in customers. Their CEO, Doug McMillon, said, "We're pleased to see more customers choosing Walmart during this inflationary period." The evidence of recession isn't just in the spending, it's also in jobs. The July jobs report affirmed this. And while the administration is celebrating employment rates surpassing pre-pandemic levels, there's some concerning data in there as well. The number of people working multiple jobs jumped 92,000, a whopping 549,000 more versus July 2021, just a year ago, reporting from Stephanie Kelton at The Lens. More data backs this argument that the recovery has been concentrated to people with college degrees, which is another major class indicator. Graduate degree holders gained 3.8 million jobs. Bachelor's degree holders gained 4.7 million jobs. And associate's degree holders gained 3.1 million jobs compared to workers with a high school diploma or less, who added only 80,000 jobs. That data comes from the Center on Education and the Workforce in Georgetown University. And now we're in this situation where the Federal Reserve has decided to tackle inflation and our current economic predicament with raising rates, really categorizing this as a demand problem, which according to the Economic Policy Institute is not supported by the data. They wrote, many countries have experienced a rapid acceleration of core inflation. A good reminder, this problem is not concentrated to the United States. Inflation is not uniquely a US problem. The economic policies that spearheaded the rapid economic recovery, rather than the specific policies of the Biden administration driving inflation, the roots of today's inflation are a more complicated cocktail of other forces, from the spike in raw material, energy, and commodities prices, due in large part to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, to lingering supply chain disruptions and distorted consumer demand patterns stemming from the pandemic. These shocks and their unexpectedly large ripple effects are the global expansion for rising inflation. So it seems as though we have taken a policy approach to solve a problem that isn't relevant to the problem. This is like if I felt very sick and I started taking antibiotics, but I didn't have an infection, and then the antibiotics made me feel more sick. Raising rates and constraining the money supply is making things worse, not better. And so this is really a story of the haves and have-nots. And we're jeopardizing our recovery by not addressing the root causes of inflation and making people worse off. And I think it can be argued that the administration might know exactly what they're doing, and it's not an accident. These are pretty smart people. But Anna, I would love to get your thoughts on all of this.
Yeah, I actually have a pretty different point of view and analysis on the idea of increasing the money supply, because when we increase the money supply, especially after the 2008 economic crash, what we saw was the Federal Reserve essentially pumping money into banks and the companies that were failing. And the idea, especially with the banks, was, okay, we're gonna give you essentially interest-free money Which you can then pump into the economy in the form of small business loans, in the form of mortgages to help fire up the mortgage market, the housing market again. And what ended up happening was these banks decided, wait, why don't we just take this free money essentially and invest it ourselves and make this money work for us. And so what they ended up doing, and we saw this also occur with private equity firms during the pandemic, is they started buying shares of their own stock. So they did corporate stock buybacks. They also went off to basically buy the inventory of homes available on the market at the time, rather than giving out mortgages to individuals who had the correct, credit score and everything necessary to qualify for a mortgage. A lot of people wouldn't even qualify for one. And so that did lead to inflation, not with everything that we're experiencing inflation-wise today, right? There are supply chain issues. The war in Ukraine obviously has something to do with it. But when it comes to so-called asset bubbles, that's where the Federal Reserve really came in and created that problem. Nomi Prinz, who wrote this really great book called Collusion, and it's not related to Russia. It's just about central banks and their role in basically increasing inequality, not just in our country, but across the globe. She talks about how this led to, people being priced out of the housing market. It led to asset bubbles, especially when it comes to the stock market. When you have corporate stock buybacks, all that really does is artificially inflate the value of the shares, because there's really no productivity or economic activity happening here. It's just a way to game the system. Now, with that said, though, what also ends up happening by increasing interest rates through the Federal Reserve is, you're right, it becomes much more expensive for ordinary working Americans to borrow money. But I think if you look back at the financialization of our economy, that is really where the root problem lies, because we started basically allowing for Americans to just take out more loans to make ends meet, rather than ensuring that their real wages were keeping up with inflation. And so if you look at the 1970s and how wages have remained stagnant since then, you'll also notice that Americans are increasingly borrowing more money through personal loans, through credit card debt. And we have record consumer debt today as a result. I think we need to go back to the pre-financialized economy, where Americans were making good money, decent wages. They were able to live the so-called American dream, and they didn't have to dig themselves into a massive amount of debt. But I do think that the Federal Reserve keeping interest rates low is actually pretty damaging to the economy.
Yeah, I think I'm so glad you brought up the point about central banks and how they're currently operating to increase the money supply, because it's a crisis and it's outdated. To have central banks decide that the way that they are going to influence our money supply is to outsource money creation to private banks. Mm-hmm. Our central bank should be confident in their ability to fund public programs with a high return on investment. We can increase the money supply in all sorts of ways. We should not have our economy running so that the central bank outsources money creation to private banks. How it currently works right now is the Federal Reserve is going to say, okay, we need more investment, we need more spending. Maybe the economy is getting a little bit cold. We're not seeing, high levels of employment. Labor might have too much power and be negotiating for too high of wages. So let's actually increase interest rates and ensure that people who are bankers have more expenses, right? It becomes more expensive for banks to borrow money from the federal government when rates go up. And then in turn, they make rates more expensive for people who want to borrow money and start businesses, invest in businesses, which will eventually, lead to more jobs, right? And so if they start these new businesses and it's only a few people who can afford them, it's pretty much people who are proven to do a good job running businesses because banks want a return on their investment. But this causing less jobs is really their intent when they're raising interest rates, right?
That's right.
Yep. If less people are working, they have less money. They're not spending that money back to the economy. But also by raising rates and curbing economic activity, what you're doing is also reducing supply. And so you're just pretty much dampening what's going on in the economy. And what can happen instead of increasing the money supply, you know, through the private sector? I would encourage everyone in Congress to realize that it's in your power to spend money with votes. You do this every year with the defense budget, passing a ton of spending for defense without backing that spending with bonds. You can do the same thing with an investment in renewable energy infrastructure and employ a bunch of Americans as well-paid public employees at a living wage. And guess what? Now the private sector has to compete with what you're offering your workers, and this raises the bottom line for everyone. And investments in things like renewable energy, like wind and solar, extremely high return on investment. So when you talk about, you know, being concerned about spending, as we'll hear Jerome Powell and Ted Cruz complaining on Fox News and all kinds of people talking about spending causing inflation, they're really afraid of what we can do with public spending, because this kind of spending is not an inflation risk if it's done right. But they're taking a ton of money from bankers who want all new money to enter our economy through the way it always has, through private banks. And it's time we realize we don't have to outsource that to private banks. So it's such a good point.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that, because you can also, I mean, I talk about the financialization of our economy. So that, I think, is the root of the problem. But I think a short-term fix, because reversing that is gonna take a lot of work, a lot of time. But I think a more short-term fix would be to establish public banking, you know, through the post office, for instance, where the government is lending directly to the American people, as opposed to giving the money to private banks, who, of course, at the end of the day, we all know what private banks want. Their bottom line is their, you know, profit motive. They want to make sure that they maximize their profits. And so you got to take that part out of the equation in order to ensure that we're actually increasing the money supply to the individuals who actually need it to maybe start their own small businesses, buy a home, whatever it is that, you know, they might need to take a loan out for. The one other thing I want to mention, because it's not all bad news, you know, you did a really good overview of the economy. You know, I'm always pretty skeptical of jobs reports, because they leave out the number of individuals who have given up on looking for work. And when you see the increase in the number of people working multiple jobs, we kind of get a sense of the quality of jobs that are out there for people to take. So I wanted to mention that. And then final thing I'll say is, look, one of the, I guess, positive aspects of the Federal Reserve increasing interest rates is that if you have a portion of your money in just a traditional savings account, I usually don't give out any financial advice because I'm not an expert, but I feel very confident in what I'm about to say. Higher interest rates mean you could also get a higher interest rate on a savings account, okay? I'm not talking about stock market stuff. I'm talking about just strictly a savings account that is not tied to the stock market. There's no risk. If you are putting your savings in like Chase Bank or Bank of America, take that money out, okay? Research online FDIC insured banks that at this point, I mean, I have mine in a bank account that is earning 2.5% interest. Make like earn some interest on that money, because it's out there, it's available, and make sure it's FDIC insured, that it's federally insured. So if the bank crashes or something, you're able to recoup your money through the federal government.
Yeah, I love that we're talking about the financialization of the economy, because so many people are like, well, the really rich guys in America must have just worked so hard and that's how they got all of their money. No, the rate of return on capital is much higher than the rate of growth in our economy right now. That's why we see inequality exacerbating to the extent that it really is. So these are people who have a sum of money, maybe they're from a very wealthy family, maybe they've acquired it in an honest way, maybe they got it through a loan. In any sense, they've acquired a lump of capital. And what they've done with all of that money is make other investments. There are many people, the richest people in our country for sure, make their money off of the existing money they already have. They're not working for it. And because the rate of return on capital is much higher than the rate of return and much faster than the rate of return on economic growth, they've amassed a ton of wealth. And it's not reflected by real goods and services, real things of value actually being produced. And we're at the point where GDP is not an accurate reflection of the total goods and services in our economy. It's a huge problem. unless we regulate Wall Street to the extreme and tax wealth extremely and tax income extremely in corporate taxes, and actually do something about stock buybacks, which Sinema rumor has it is the reason that people were removing it from the IRA.
And oh, so, God, she's the freaking worst.
She's the worst.
I can't stand her. I really can't. And like the shamelessness of everything she's up to lately, it's just can't stand her. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you. Continue.
Yeah, and she's fighting for these guys because they're lining her pockets. And it's not in the interest of anyone to have these people have the ability to inflate their stock. I've got an announcement, Unbossed with Senator Nina Turner on her daily show. It's starting October 17th, but you can early subscribe now. She'll expose the corrupt forces that keep the power from the people. And she's gonna talk about what we can do to fix the corruption. She'll be talking about all of the corruption on her show, Unbossed. You can subscribe at tyt.com/unbossedtyt. All right, and are we ready to go into this next story?
Super ready, let's give it to them.
This is a good one, it's about housing. I'm excited we're covering it when Anna's on. The rent is too damn high, let's watch.
Allow me to introduce myself. I represent the rent is too damn high party. People are working 8 hours a day and 40 hours a week to some a third job. Women can't afford to take care of their children, feed their children breakfast, lunch, and dinner. My main job is to provide a roof over your head, food on the table, and money in your pocket. This is politics as usual, playing a silly game. It's not gonna happen. The rent too damn high movement, the people I'm here to represent can't afford to pay their rent. They're being laid off right now as I speak. They can't eat breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Listen, someone's stomach, child's stomach just growled. Did you hear it? You gotta listen like me.
Okay.
Let's talk about the issue.
People can't afford to pay their rent. 30 seconds for you, sir.
Rent is too damn high.
Thank you.
The rent is too damn high. I agree. And what a great response from Cuomo. He's like, someone's actually talking about real issues that affect everyday working people. How do I react? The rent is still too damn high. That was a very long time ago. But an analysis published in Redfin shows that median rent in the United States surpassed $2,000 for the first time in May. This is median, not the mean. It's not like this is an average and outliers of people who are paying tons of money in rent in downtown Manhattan are pulling this figure up. This is the median figures. That means taking everyone in the population, what their rent is, and taking the number that's in the very middle. This is a very high rent to be the median for the entire country. At $7.25 per hour, you would need to work 63 hours per week and give all of those wages to your landlord to pay rent to afford this. Do we exist just to work for other people to pay our bills to survive? This isn't a meaningful existence, just getting up and working every day to continue to have a home. It doesn't make sense. July's consumer price index showed rent inflation increased at a rate of 6.3% in the past year, which is the highest in 35 years. And it gets worse because in some cities, it's much higher than that. Rents are up 30 to 50% in some cities across the United States right now. And it's possible that it's even worse than these big figures show. The CPI's use of current lease costs instead of a market cost causes the CPI measure to lag behind broader rental and housing market trends by around 6 to 12 months. The CPI estimates shelter costs through a survey of renters who are asked about the cost of rent they currently pay. Because rental lease contracts tend to lock in rents for 6 to 12 months, this measure will, one, only slowly track current market trends, and two, usually exhibit less volatility if rollover leases don't adjust fully to market rates. And there are all sorts of folks across the country who are very vocal about how this is affecting them. Tenant leader Vanessa Armour, who's with the Progressive Leadership Alliance of Nevada and Homes Guarantee, said, "I feel trapped. Am I going to spend the rest of my life scraping it all together while the government does nothing to help me? While the government is actually in the business of financing greedy landlords like mine?" And so to explore this, People's Action, a national network of community organizing groups, along with Data for Progress, investigated how everyday people feel about rent, and they focused in on voters. They wrote this in a report. We asked voters how concerned they are about the cost of renting a home or apartment. Nearly two-thirds of likely voters, 64%, report that they are either very concerned or somewhat concerned. Across partisanship, we find that 70% of Democrats, 63% of independents, and 58% of Republicans are concerned about the cost of renting a home or an apartment. And so that was voters overall. And when you break this down between those who are renters and those who are homeowners, it's still pretty damning. So among voters who say they are tenants, we find that 80% are concerned about the cost of renting a home or apartment, while 56% of voters who report they are homeowners are concerned. Groundwork Collaborative Director of Policy Research Mike Mitchell said, any strategy to bring down prices must include housing and affordability. Landlords and housing corporations are telling their investors they're ready to jack up rents as much as possible. If our policy fixes for inflation don't target the housing market, we risk falling to meet one of the most urgent needs of millions across the country. And so he's right about the solution for bringing prices down needing to consider rents. Because the current approach to curb inflation, as we've talked about a lot, of raising rates, is exacerbating the wealth inflation issue. So Tiffany Wielding with MarketWatch reported that when the Federal Reserve raises rates, as it has recently, rental inflation tends to rise in response, at least at first. This is because rising rates make owning a home less affordable, pushing would-be buyers into the rental market, which in turn further drives up rents. This is not to mention that about 30% of the homes on the market right now are going to investors, not going to home buyers who plan on living in those homes. And again, this is a problem of price gouging. Rents have outpaced inflation, suggesting that landlords are price gouging. In the midst of this crisis, rents rose over 14% year over year in June, much higher than the overall inflation rate of 9.1%. So what can we do about it? The folks at Homes Guarantee, led by Tara Raghuveer, published something for the administration and departments to look at. They have some recommendations for what kind of executive actions can be taken. They said President Biden must declare a state of emergency on housing and issue an executive order to essentially work with many tenants to work against the private rental market against unreasonable rent hikes. To convene a cabinet level interagency task force with identifying avenues for longer term collaboration to regulate rents and secure tenants' rights, and to provide a formal avenue for federal agencies to consult with tenant stakeholders, including tenants themselves. I think that's a great idea. I would love to see tenant leaders like Denise Brown, for example, from Kansas City Tenants, advising the Biden administration on what to do with the housing crisis. We need everyday people participating in our government. That's what democracy looks like to me. But I'm really glad we have Anna on to chat about this because Anna loves talking about housing. What are your thoughts? I think you're muted, Anna.
Sorry about that.
There we go. So
a lot of thoughts. You know, when you mentioned the idea of Joe Biden declaring an emergency surrounding housing, he's not going to do it. I would be shocked if he did. And then I immediately thought about the fact that he had no problem implementing an executive order to prevent railroad workers from striking legally. Just a thought, like see where his priorities are. But in terms of policy, you're right in regard to interest rates, making it more expensive for people to take out mortgages so they get further priced out of the market. But at the same time, there is the added benefit of the price of single family homes or townhouses, you know, homes you can actually buy. The price comes down because if it's too expensive to borrow, well, then it limits the number of people who are able to buy those homes. And so for anyone who's been storing away cash, hoping to one day buy their home, it makes it a little easier to do that. And property taxes are also calculated based on the value of the home. So if the value of the home goes down, your property taxes are also gonna be lower. But that does also price people, some people out of the housing market in terms of wanting to, you know, if they wanna buy property. And then they end up wanting to rent. And that increases the demand of individuals looking for rental properties, and there's limited supply. And so I want to address the issues with limited supply, because outside of the executive order that Biden, that has been suggested for Joe Biden, I think there also needs to be some regulations pertaining to what type of buildings get built, right? Because we keep hearing about zoning laws, they're too restrictive, we need to loosen them. But if you drive around Los Angeles, for instance, and I know this is happening in a lot of other major cities, you will see quite a bit of construction. It's just that the construction is being done on massive developments that include either luxury condos or luxury apartment buildings that are astronomically priced. And then what they do is this annoying trick that I think some people on the left absolutely fall for, which is, oh, it's mixed use. It's mixed use. There's gonna be affordable housing, you know, baked into this. And then you read the terms and you find out that the number of affordable units is like 5%. And the rest of the building is either renting at market value or even above market value. So what I would wanna see is policy that prevents these major developers and these big corporations from taking advantage of those loosened zoning laws for their own profit motive and their own purposes, right? We need to ensure that whatever we do build actually increases the supply of affordable housing. And you would need a lot more involvement of, you know, the public sector to make that happen. Aside from that, I would ban foreign investment in US real estate completely. At least for the time being. So if you're some oligarch in China or in any country, Saudi Arabia, for instance, not interested in you snatching up residential property to basically launder your money here in the United States. I would ban that on day one. It's insane to me that we haven't done that yet.
Yeah, I would totally see like raising interest rates as the policy solution if we weren't in this situation where large developers were controlling a third of the market and buying homes outright just so that they can rent them out, oftentimes as short-term rentals, which are much higher than regular long-term leases. And then you have the people who are actually looking for long-term leases paying this high price for rent. But when 30% of the market is controlled by these corporate investors, and you have corporations like Zillow coming in and purchasing 5 homes. They'll purchase 3 at like $200,000 and then purchase an additional 2 at $400,000, effectively increasing the price, the estimated value of the first 3 homes they purchased. And now they can sell those at a $200,000 gain. When you have this kind of profiteering leading to the increased prices of homes, unfortunately, this isn't a circumstance where interest rates are gonna do much about that. And so Anna's totally right that what we need to have happen is the public sector step in, some regulation of this market, because it's not serving the people to have homes be this expensive. People are losing their homes, they're getting evicted and they're becoming homeless. And it seems that the policy solution, at least here in Los Angeles, is to criminalize homelessness, unfortunately, to make it illegal for people to be living in the streets. And so it's a really sad state of affairs.
When Donald Trump really endorses someone, he goes big. You've seen none of that for Lion Matt Gaetz. What does Trump know? Is Gaetz the informant? Gaetz hired Jeffrey Epstein's attorney. Another Epstein attorney approved the raid on Trump's house. Remember, Gaetz pressured Trump to give him a pardon, but Trump said no. Matt Gaetz puts himself first, ahead of Trump and ahead of you. Vote for a leader who will put America first. Vote for Marine Mark Lombardo.
I'm Mark Lombardo. I approve this message.
So that was an ad from Matt Gaetz's primary opponent, Mark Lombardo. Florida Representative Matt Gaetz's Republican primary opponent, Mark, suggested in this new attack ad that we just watched that the incumbent congressman is the possible informant in the FBI's raid on former President Trump at his Mar-a-Lago estate. The 30-second political ad called The Informant? Suggests that Gates had something to do with last week's unprecedented search of Trump's Palm Beach, Florida property, while claiming that Trump has not gone big to endorse Gates. Gates' campaign also made a new ad showing Trump praising Gates and saying that the congressman has an endorsement from me, 100% endorsement. Others are theorizing that the FBI informant is someone who is much closer to Trump, maybe even in his inner circle, his own family. So aides to former President Donald Trump believe that a member of his family may have tipped off the FBI about the presence of classified documents at Mar-a-Lago, The Guardian reported. In the search, agents took more than a dozen boxes of items, as well as highly classified information. They appeared to have specific information about what to look for. Some aides were convinced that only a family member would have known to point agents to a particular leather-bound box, as well as knowing the location of Trump's safe. Both Trump's estranged niece, Mary, and his former attorney, Michael Cohen, have speculated that Jared Kushner, the former president's son-in-law, could be the informant. Neither offered evidence to back the claim. But what we do know for sure is that Trump is already grifting. He's already been using this raid as a way to make some money. So former President Trump bombarded his supporters with more than 100 emails asking for money based on the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago for classified materials last week, and they paid off. Contributions to Trump's political action committee topped $1 million on at least 2 days after the August 8th search of his Palm Beach, Florida estate, according to two people familiar with the figures. The daily hauls jumped from a level of $200,000 to $300,000 that had been typical in recent months. According to people who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss non-public information. I struggle with the word anonymity, like anemone. In finding the email. But let's watch this really quick. It's a fun reminder of Trump's position on classified documents and the rule of law just 6 years ago. Let's watch.
In my administration, I'm going to enforce all laws concerning the protection of classified information. No one will be above the law.
Wow. No one will be above the law. What a change in tune. Anna, what are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, I mean, look, my thoughts are, first off, let me comment on the very first video that we showed the audience of that political ad. I think it's so pathetic when anyone, I mean, have some self-respect. Oh, Matt Gaetz puts himself before Trump. I don't think that's true, first of all, and I don't think that's a good thing. Like, you should put yourself before Trump. Trump is just some random person who managed to make his way to the White House, and he was obviously unqualified and is a doofus. And the idea of putting this random person ahead of yourself and your family is insane. So I just want to make that point. Secondly, I think that the FBI informant is, you know, Jared Kushner is a good theory, actually. But I would also venture to say that it's Melania Trump. Because Melania Trump despises him. I think it's pretty clear. It's shocking that they haven't divorced yet. I remember when he was in office, she was trying to renegotiate the terms of their prenup. And I just feel like she would know about the safe. I suspect it's Melania. That's my theory. We'll see. But I do think that there might be some truth to Kushner also serving as the FBI informant. The thing is, he's married to Ivanka. I think Ivanka is still pretty loyal to her dad. So that's why I give Melania, you know, the betrayal point in this whole story. But we'll see what happens. At the end of the day, he broke the law. So not only did he do that, he did it in a way that jeopardizes incredibly sensitive material, documents that can only be viewed in a secure government facility, documents pertaining to secrets for nuclear weapons and things like that. I mean, I'm usually very dubious of anyone who claims, oh, the leaking of classified documents is going to put national security in jeopardy. More often than not, the classified documents that they're referring to or classified, information and data that they're referring to is just something that's super embarrassing to the United States military, right? They gun down or do drone strikes against ordinary civilians or at weddings. Like, that's what got WikiLeaks in trouble. That's what got Chelsea Manning in trouble. But at the end of the day, if it pertains to nuclear weapons, yeah, it's incredibly dangerous for Trump to take those documents with him to Mar-a-Lago, which clearly is not a secure place to have them.
Totally. I'm a huge fan of ProPublica's reporting, and they reported that they put a boat out on the water nearby Trump's mansion, and they determined that they could hack the computers at Mar-a-Lago within hours. So think about the international security risk of classified information being there. Insane. My hot take is that the informant is Barron Trump, because I think teenagers are built different these days. And I think he could have very easily DM'd some FBI agent on social media and said, I'll help you out, man.
Maybe he's the ultimate robber baron. You know what I'm saying?
There, like, we go.
Send my dad to prison and I'll take over. Who knows? Who knows? We'll see. I mean, the drama continues. Who's not titillated by this?
Just a teenager sitting there like, how do I get rid of this guy?
Yeah.
Amazing. All right. We've got to take another break. We'll be back after this. So two judges who sent children to for-profit jails and received illegal payments for doing so have been ordered to pay more than $200 million in damages, a judge ruled on Tuesday. U.S. District Judge Christopher Connor awarded $106 million in compensatory damages and $100 million in punitive damages to nearly 300 people in a long-running civil suit against the judges, writing the plaintiffs are the tragic human casualties of a scandal of epic proportions. In what came to be known as the Kids for Cash scandal, Mark Civarella and another judge, Michael Conahan, shut down a county-run juvenile detention center, so a government jail, a public prison, and accepted $2.8 million in illegal payments from the builder and co-owner of two for-profit lockups. Lockups meaning prisons. Civarella, who presided over juvenile court, pushed a zero tolerance policy that guaranteed large numbers of kids would be sent to PA Childcare and its sister facility, Western PA Childcare. So we've got a photo of these guys who were involved. Civarella ordered children as young as 8 to detention, many of them first-time offenders convicted of petty theft and other minor crimes. The judge often ordered youths he had found legally delinquent to be immediately shackled, handcuffed, and taken away without giving them a chance to say goodbye to their families. The Pennsylvania State Supreme Court threw out some 4,000 juvenile convictions after the scheme was uncovered. It's not clear now whether the plaintiffs, now well into adulthood, who have spent their childhood in this for-profit prison, we'll see any of the substantial damages that are awarded through this civil suit. And I would also point out that, you know, Civarella is serving time himself. I'm not sure if we can say this is nearly enough compared to how many years he's put children in prison, but he's serving 28 years. And Conahan was released to home confinement in 2020 after serving 11 of his 17-year sentence. So I think it's a good time to point out that these are people who are judges in a position of power, putting people against their will in for-profit prisons, meaning that they are going to have to do labor when they're in prison. And presently, the 13th Amendment in the United States outlaws slavery except as punishment for a crime. And it's very clear that these people used a lot of discretion, these judges, to determine what is and what is not a crime. Oftentimes, petty theft, 8 years old, people stealing maybe to feed themselves. Really disgusting that this is still happening, and really important to shed light on it. Anna, what are your thoughts?
I remember when this story broke years ago and Civarella's sentence was announced, and it was so good to see that there would be some justice in that case, because if you look at the specific cases in which he sent juveniles to these private juvenile facilities, it was just so abundantly clear that he was criminalizing all sorts of ridiculous, innocent, and nonviolent issues. So I remember one student, for instance, brought a lunch from home that I don't remember if it was a female or male, but whatever. The student brings it to school and their mother accidentally put like one of those plastic knives in there, like the, you know, plastic fork knife. It comes in like a little packet. And the student was prosecuted for that. It was insane, absolutely insane. And the idea of taking kickbacks from the corporations that run these private juvenile facilities, and in return, you send innocent children to the facilities and treat them like hardened criminals. It was just so incredibly disgusting. And one thing that we have to be clear on is that having a profit motive associated with our criminal justice system, having private prisons and private juvenile facilities in the first place is wrong, and it incentivizes the mass incarceration of nonviolent Americans. And in this case, we're talking about actual children. It is insane, and it should be completely outlawed, not just on a federal level, which accounts for a much smaller portion of private prisons, but certainly on a state level. No state should allow for private prisons or juvenile facilities to exist.
Yeah, I'm super against, you know, all prisons, and people get so scared. They're like, what do you mean? We can't have any prisons. I really believe in abolition, in getting rid of prisons, because in South Africa, where I lived for some time, they really take an approach to criminal justice that's about reconciliation. Oftentimes, even in cases of violent crimes, if people sit in a room with each other and talk about what's happening, why they committed the crime they did with the victim or the victim's family, they reach agreements. And to just put people in cages, I mean, especially for nonviolent offenses, isn't a solution. And when we think about what types of things we're considering crimes, we need to interrogate, are these things that really make me feel unsafe? Do I feel unsafe because a kid brings a plastic knife in their lunchbox to the school? Is this something that is deeply wrong? Have they broken a social contract with me to the point where, you know, I don't want to live with them anymore and they need to be put in a cage? No. And it can be scary to think, what if we get rid of the police? What if we get rid of prisons? It's not that there will be no systems there to ensure that people treat each other well. It's just we need new and better systems because these current systems are not working at all. And Sophie, our producer, pointed out, sorry, you want to respond to that? I'm going to bring up something else.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, I just wanted to quickly mention, I disagree. I think that there is a place for prisons. I think we need to reform our prisons and look to what I think is a model that works really well, especially when you consider the low rates of recidivism. Some of these Scandinavian countries, Norway, for instance, I think Norway is doing it correctly. But I do think that there are certain violent criminals who do pose a danger to society and need to be taken out of society and rehabilitated if that's a possibility. And we don't rehabilitate anyone. And look, to be honest with you, living in LA and seeing some of these unarmed ambassadors replacing armed deputies, you know, I thought that was going to be a great idea, a great plan. We've seen how it's played out, and it has not yielded great results, to be clear. There are people who are armed with illegal guns and, again, dangers to society, and I don't think abolition is the way to go. I just want to be clear about that.
Yeah, I think what Anna and I are demonstrating is how sometimes people on the left can agree on certain things, but use different language. Like, I think it's a great idea to have people who are like serial killers, for example, to be sanctioned. You have to stay there. You have to talk with the psychologist for quite some time, and you cannot leave. You cannot go out into the world, and you need to heal and figure out, you know, why you're like this. And maybe you always have to be in a sort of a home where you're living with other people, which I would categorize as maybe not a prison. Maybe that, you know, isn't a punishment where you're put in a cage and hopefully that will reform you and you sit in shame.
Yeah.
I think
the conditions in our prisons have to change. I mean, you know, I remember when Anders Breivik was complaining, and this is the guy who, you know, committed a terrorist attack in Norway, and he's imprisoned as we speak. But there was like this big story about how he was complaining about the gaming system they put in his cell. And it's like, look, we have no room to talk. They're doing it right. We're not. So anyway.
I wish those were our criticisms. We'll see you on the other side. Hota Suave. I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, or Hota Suave, who said, Anna, I've been waiting for you to be on the damage report so I can share my dragon name. I have decided on Anna Kasparian saying feckless dragon. Nothing makes me happier than when you're a little salty and you say feckless.
Yeah, I love that word because it sounds like I'm gonna drop an F-bomb, which I definitely wanna drop, but I can't on the show. So feckless is perfect. Thank you. I love that.
I need to incorporate feckless into my regular vocabulary now.
It's a great word.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.